This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The number of families in North Carolina homeschooling their children is on the rise, and there appears to be no one reason for the increase. The homeschooling movement has always featured a hodgepodge of political views ranging from stubborn segregationists to permissive hippies. So homeschooling has become less religious in the state. This school year, just over half of homeschools registered as religious, and that compares to 78% 30 years ago. So we're going to talk about homeschooling today. If you've had an experience with homeschooling, or if you have questions about it, whether it's the theory of various theories, the pedagogy, any of those questions, you can call us at 877-962-9862. If you've had an experience, you're a homeschooling family, let us know. You can tweet at us, or you can email us at sot@wnc.org. And to help us dig into the numbers and the history and the story of homeschooling, I'd like to welcome two scholars from the School of Education at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Thad Domina and Ethan Hutt. Thad, welcome to the State of Things.
Hi, thanks.
Good to have you here. Ethan, good to have you as well.
Good to be here.
Also want to introduce the heads of two small schools in Durham. Hope Wilder is executive director at Pathfinder Community School, and Valene Ziegler is the founder and head of Empowered Minds. Hope, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. Nice to be here.
Good to have you, Valene. Thank you for coming to the State of Things.
Thank you so much.
877-962-9862 is the number to call if you want to join us. Ethan, let me start with you. Homeschooling has a long history. People have been doing it since the beginning of humanity. But let's talk about the modern era and take a look at the 60s and 70s. When homeschooling gets kind of another push. Talk about that in this state.
Yeah, so we historians usually think about the homeschooling movement, the modern homeschooling movement, as starting in the late 60s, early 70s. And what you see in that period is you have a bunch of different stuff going on in the nation. You have desegregation happening. You have a push towards equalization of state funding, and you have an increasing trend towards centralized decision-making around curriculum and teacher licensure and things like that. And so what you see out of that, you get really two camps that develop. On the left, you get people who feel like schools represent a pernicious bureaucracy. They represent a sort of an attempt to make all students the same, and they're restrictive. And so you start getting a left movement that really is pushing for de-schooling, unschooling, trying to remove students from what they consider a negative environment. And so you get a push from the left towards homeschooling. And on the right, you see kind of in the wake of culture wars, concerns that schools no longer represent community values, a push from the religious side to create communities that schools that reflect those values. And so you get a push from sort of the left and the right to establish homeschooling, and the law sort of follows after. You get a push for homeschooling. And then in the 80s, you see a lot of lawsuits, people pushing to clarify what compulsory school laws really say about homeschooling. And so you see a lot of states trying to update and clarify whether homeschools count as private schools and are regulated as private schools, or whether they represent something different. And so in the 80s and 90s, you see a lot of litigation, and most states in that period are updating their laws to clarify their stance about homeschooling.
That, as we said, in this state, there's been quite a change since, say, 1989, since the late 80s. When the vast majority, over three quarters of the schools homeschooling families in this state identified as religious schools or religious families, and that has now gone down to just over 50%. Have you been tracking that, and do we know what accounts for that change in the trend?
We don't. We have the sense that it's something that's happening broadly across the United States. But in truth, homeschooling is a very difficult topic to study sort of systematically. Homeschooling is fairly rare. The National Center for Education Statistics estimates that about 3% of American school-age kids are homeschooled. Homeschoolers are very, very diverse. It's a heterogeneous, as Ethan was explaining, it's a heterogeneous movement with a lot of different ways of approaching. But one common thread is some level of dissatisfaction, and in many cases, distrust of the educational system, which again makes it difficult to sort of systematically study homeschoolers. So I don't think we have a strong sense of of what's driving the growth in secular homeschooling.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Distrust for a lot of reasons, right? On the right, you might say, well, I don't like some of these theories on diversity, perhaps, on science. A lot of these theories that get taught in schools are offensive to various religious groups or political groups. And then on the left, well, you know, we're inhibiting creativity. This is not the way to learn. This is not the way to develop. Not to mention the fact that a lot of curricula left out many, many, many voices. And so if you were listening in the, certainly when I grew up, I didn't hear the voices of Native Americans or African Americans represented in my history book. So there'd be a good reason for a progressive family to say, I don't like those textbooks, right? So that's kind of what's going on here. Hope, let's talk a little bit about Pathfinder Community Schools and your school and some of the what happens at Pathfinder.
Sure. I'll just have to correct you that technically we're an educational membership organization for registered homeschoolers. We're not actually a school. But what happens at Pathfinder is that we let the children self-direct their learning. And so on a day-to-day basis, that means that they get to choose their activities within a community structure. So we like to say that community is the curriculum. We're teaching collaborative decision-making, group governance through a method called sociocracy. But we also give the children lots of spare time to play freely. And whenever they do something, it's because they're consenting to that activity. So we have lots of fun offerings that I think are really interesting, like science or going on walks to the creek or organized games. But the children always have a choice to leave the room when they're no longer interested in whatever's being presented.
Are they monitored when they leave the room? Is there someone
with them? We have five staff and 25 kids, yeah. And the staff wander around the building, but it's a very home-like environment.
And are the kids there all day? This is not just an activity in the middle of their day, or they can be there all day?
They can be there all day. So we're open from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., but the kids can arrive anytime before 10:30 when we have a meeting to start the day, and anyone can make an offering to the community of an organized activity. And then they go home between 2:30 and 3.
And what about this? So I can anticipate these questions now. How do we track how well they're doing? How do we know that anything has happened at the end of a year?
We trust them, Frank. We trust that they're learning and growing. And yeah. I feel very strongly that it is not up to the children to prove to me that they've learned anything. Mm-hmm. However, I do very closely observe the kids. I blog about the kinds of learning that I see happening, and I enjoy their company. They also have mentors. So the staff, all of the staff have kids who are their assigned mentees who they check in with regularly, and they ask questions like, what do you like? What do you not like? What do you want to see more of? And also, what are your interests? What are you passionate about? And how can we make that happen for you here? So the staff are absolutely there to help children make their dreams come true. We're just not forcing them into a program not of their choosing.
All right. So this is a very open-ended approach that
yes.
starts with the student, follows their curiosity, yeah. and then guides them in ways that might perhaps direct some
I don't
of them.
Like the yeah. word guide,
All
really.
Right.
It's more, I like the word support.
All right.
Because we're really responding to the interests of the child and just making them know about resources and letting them know what's possible. But the choice is always theirs. And there's no force. There's no, it's not like Montessori where we say you have three options, A, B, or C, or we say you can do these things in any order you want. It's really, you can absolutely do whatever you want. And if that's drawing pictures of Pokemon all day, you do it. And I love your Pokemon pictures and show me all your Pokemon pictures. And I don't feel like it's necessary to measure how good your Pokemon picture is. There's no measurement for that. And it's a self-measurement. It's a self-assessment.
Valene, tell us about Empowered Minds Academy.
Well, in contrast, we are listed on the North Carolina Department of Non-Public Ed as a private school. However, we embrace the phrase learner-driven community. So we do value self-paced learning. We value mastery, mastery over self, how do I learn best, and mastery over skills and even character development. And I guess I'm really tempted to share a piece of my background. I did teach public school for 7 years, and I enjoyed it tremendously, even with all of its challenges and difficulties. I was a department chair, mentor teacher, literacy coach, and earned National Board certification because I enjoyed it that much. I enjoyed thinking deeply about education. Once my husband and I became pregnant, we decided to homeschool. Even though I was so passionate about being a public school teacher, we knew we wanted to homeschool.
Why?
A distrust of the roots of the industrialized education model. So I appreciate you referencing that. We really believed that public schools overall were designed to do what they were supposed to do, and that is squash creativity. So we were really interested in our children really owning themselves as writers, readers, historians, and we wanted to cultivate leaders, not employees or workers, which is what we wanted to avoid. So at EMA, it's not a coercive model. We do have guides, not teachers.
Well, let's get to the phone calls, because I think they can help us unpack a little bit more about individually. I know you've raised, both of you, a lot of questions about how this works. We'll look at the pedagogy. We've got two experts here in Thad Domina and Ethan Hutt, both professors at UNC Chapel Hill School of Education, Hope Wilder's executive director at Pathfinder, and Valene Ziegler, founder and head of Empowered Minds. And you are on the line as well. Let's go to the lines where Joe is here from Wilson County. Hello, Joe.
Hello. Good afternoon. Yes, I just want to tell you, just express my experience. You know, we initially, we have three kids, young kids, elementary school, and we initially looked at homeschooling because we weren't happy with the performance of the public schools. I think that's the real driver, is it's not so much that we were pro-homeschool, it's that we were completely dissatisfied with the educational options that are available in public schools. You know, you have a lot of failing schools, a lot of mediocre schools, and of course, like all parents, we want the best education for our kids, and it's just not there. The schools just are not performing the way they should be. And so we looked into homeschooling, but we found that a lot of the effort, the burden, the responsibility of teaching then falls back on the parents, and we weren't convinced that we were equipped to do that for a long period of time, that it was the appropriate solution. And so, and also I think it really deprives the kids of having a really full education, you know, having being a part of a class, being a part of a greater school that can participate in sports and school-to-school competitions and, you know, just really having a large group of kids that are your age that you see every day and that you experience, you know, have a similar set of experiences.
So then did you ultimately decided to then send them to school?
They are in public school. They were in private school, and that has become very expensive. And so we're actually looking at leaving the state.
Well, you've raised a couple of really good questions, Joe, and I want to give our guests time to respond to them. So thank you for calling. Let's talk about them one at a time. One is the amount of time this takes. I mean, do you have to be a privileged family where one person can stay home? Is homeschooling a privilege that not all families can even enjoy should they choose? I'll start with you and ask how you, Hope and Valene, whether or not you address that. Can a working family even choose to become part of this?
I mean,
because they're sending,
honestly,
in your
that's
case.
That's one of the reasons that I started Pathfinder, was for families who believe in specifically the unschooling philosophy, but for whom either single parent families where the single parent needs to be working, or working families where both parents need a place to have their children while they go make income. So it absolutely is a privilege, and many homeschool families, I think it's a lifestyle choice that they lose a lot of income by one parent not working to take care of the child.
All right. Valene?
Yeah, I can definitely speak to that. When I stopped working full-time, my husband and I, it was a huge sacrifice. We lost an entire income. In fact, we moved in order so that I could stay home full-time. And actually, we've been a single income family since. I mean, Empowered Minds Academy is a new community. So it's still something that I'm very passionate about. Also for homeschooling families who are limited in income, provided that you do your research and you really believe in taking that brave and courageous step of leaving a conventional school, there is support out there and you can build support and create support. I was part of a homeschooling co-op for over 10 years, and I still connect with a lot of those members.
Would this be some blend then of perhaps supervised activities that you schedule throughout the week where you wouldn't have to be there as a parent and then back home for...
There's different expressions of that. There's a cooperative where parents share responsibilities. There's regular meetings. You can really create, design, and structure it to fit what you want for your family.
What's the age range at Empowered Minds?
We are currently age 6. Oh, wait, ages 5 through 13 currently.
All right. What about at Pathfinder?
Ages 5 to 14.
All right. Talk about, let me ask you, Ethan, and then Thad, this business of privilege. Is it a privilege? Do I have to be an upper-income family in order to even consider homeschooling?
I mean, there's certainly a range of families that engage in homeschooling. There's no question that, you know, to replicate a school environment to educate your child is a huge investment of time, of effort. One of the things we've seen over time in the homeschool movement is a development of resources, whether online or in-person communities. So you see sort of a hybridization where a lot of homeschool families subscribe to magazines or avail themselves of resources that are out there on the internet and or out there just, you know, in communities, and they're shared. So there is an attempt to sort of, I won't use the word institutionalize, but create some structure and some scaffolding around families that are trying to do it. But there's no question it's a huge investment for families that do it.
Thad, another question that Joe raised is, broadly speaking, socialization, but it has to do with, he talked about a broader education, about participating in sports and, you know, meeting with kids from other backgrounds and all of that. Is there research on, you know, the value, the relative values of homeschooling and whether or not there's a loss or a gain in that broad category, socialization? Maybe you could even narrow that down for me.
I think there are really very important concerns in that area. Again, unfortunately, about the research, I have to be a kind of a broken record. It's not great. We don't know a lot. But the worries are about sort of democratization. I mean, one thing that we count on our public schools to do is to build citizens. And that involves some coercion in some cases. It involves some socialization. But it's an important part of what our public schools do. So I think you worry about sports, you worry about time with friends, and you also worry about teaching children to see themselves as members of a community. And you know, when I spend time with homeschoolers, I see a lot of great thought about how to do that. And a lot of different approaches about how to do it, but it's a big challenge, I think, for homeschoolers.
And I do think, I mean, again, you talked about the resources, Ethan. I mean, that homeschoolers do network, and then they find each other, and they find things to do together, and there tends to be a broader cross-section. So they're not really just sitting home 5 days or 7 days a week. Most homeschoolers do get out and participate in other activities. Do you have any, I don't know, I mean, that's my experience because I know a lot of people who do it and they seem to be very well networked, but it is a lot of work to get it all stitched together for sure.
Sure, and if I may add or just talk about how intentional we are at EMA about our role in the lives of learners, it is not a coercive model, it's not a top-down model in that they are equipped and empowered to take over their workspaces or their studios as quickly as possible. I'm actually covenant promised in that I'm obligated to step back and let them fail within safe parameters and learn from their mistakes. So we're very intentional about the words we use, the questions we use, and they have ample freedom and choice to get into the flow, play, do their work.
We'll continue our conversation about homeschooling and alternate education today. You can join us at 877-962-9862 on the State of Things when we return. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, continuing our conversation on homeschooling and all the questions that come with it. 877-962-9862 is the number to call if you want to join the conversation. You can tweet at us or email us at sot@wunc.org, 877-962-9862. Thad Domina is here, along with Ethan Hutt. They are scholars at UNC Chapel Hill School of Education. Also, the leaders of two small schools in Durham working to address issues of class and race among homeschooling families. Valene Ziegler is the founder and head of Empowered Minds Academy. Hope Weiler is executive director of Pathfinder Community. Our number is 877-962-9862. Lots of calls. Get to them in a minute. But Hope, you wanted to talk about this question just before the break about citizenship and whether or not homeschooling or more intentional kinds of programs like yours limit us in terms of who we become exposed to and limit our possibilities as citizens.
Right. And so I guess I just want to make everybody aware that there is an international movement to democratize education. And there are democratic schools all over the world, public democratic schools, especially in India. If you look to Brazil, there's a lot of public democratic schools where the idea is to build citizens by letting children engage in a democratic process on a daily basis. So basically by empowering them to make decisions, they feel like free, responsible citizens that they should grow into in a fair and free democratic society. I would love to have our educational model trickle out into the wider world, and I think that's something that public schools could give students more choice about how they learn, teachers more choice about how they teach, and also to give them a voice in even simple things like when lunch happens or bathroom breaks that have nothing to do with pedagogy, but that have everything to do with modeling, citizenship, democracy, how to go to meetings, and how to get things done.
Is there a chance, though, that because I've chosen this particular school and I've got a lot of like-minded parents, or we're staying at home where there's exposure to even fewer children and now everybody's going to look like me? What about that question about exposure?
Right. I mean, diversity, equity, inclusion is a huge problem. And I think the real problem is in the larger world. We live in a segregated society in the South. So at Pathfinder, we're absolutely committed to racial equity work, and we're committed to diversifying our student population. We have a board mandate to have our demographics mirror the demographics of the Durham community, and we're not there yet. We had especially that kind of founder bias of the first people who start a community. So it's a work in progress.
Well, I'm going to go to the phones now, make sure we get our callers on the air. Andrew is on the line from Asheville. Hello, Andrew. What do you have to say for us?
Hi, Frank. Yes, I was homeschooled for all but 1 year, just second grade as when I went to a public school. And I find from talking to other homeschoolers that we share so little of our experience compared to people who went to different high schools, public high schools. That's one thing. And the other thing is I can say is really great about homeschooling was that it made me a voracious learner. Like I learned how to self-educate, but what it did not teach me was how to be integrated into a bigger education system or prepare me to enter college. And that really caused a lot of struggle for me in my early adulthood. And I know that some parents are much better about that. My parents really wanted to see me, find a career in Christianity. And when that, wasn't my choice, I lost all my advocates to start my early adulthood. And I feel that had I been high schooled and sent to a public high school, I would have had other people that I could have gone to for help and assistance that would have helped me and shared my dreams. And I really feel that if homeschooling by parents up through middle school can be a really good idea, but after that, there's just no way that two people can compete with the infrastructure and the preparation that a public or good private school system can provide.
Well, let me get a response to that. Thank you very much, Andrew. That's really food for thought. Thad Domina, let me ask you again, if not the research, what we know about in any way integration. I know some kids will go to high school. They'll be homeschooled through middle. Some stay all the way through high school. And then, ultimately, you would think you're going to go to college. What's the integration process like? Do we know if things are harder, easier for them, or is it kind of split?
Well, I can tell you that I've spoken to undergraduates who've come to college after homeschooling, and the caller's sentiments are fairly widely felt. There is a sort of hidden curriculum just in being part of a math education system and seeing oneself in relation to a structure that students do struggle to learn. And I think that at any point at which a student is moving between the two systems, that's going to be a challenge. Because I do think that a strength of a public education system, probably in particular a public education system, is that it takes children from across a very diverse society and puts them into a set of rules that are shared and allows them to teaches them to negotiate and to be themselves in the context of those rules. And that's an important experience for kids.
Well, Valine, that has come up again. Talk more about this integration and being in a diverse population while you're learning.
Yeah, I just want to take a dive in and offer that perhaps that's about culture and getting accustomed to a culture and learning how to navigate different paradigms, different systems. At EMA in particular, especially around middle school, high school, we offer the challenge to earn an apprenticeship, to get out into the real world. We don't have a high school in place now, but the idea is that they are out in the world at least two or three times a year, working in real spaces, working with mentors, and provided that the learner, along with their parents in agreement, they want to go to college, then they pursue that. So our model offers that and more.
Well, I'd like to go back to the phones right now and make sure we get another caller on. Kate is on the line from Cary. Hello, Kate.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I homeschooled my kids from 1993 to 2015. I have four of them. Three I took all the way through high school, and one went to public high school. And I think, you know, there were a lot of changes, obviously, in me as well as in the law and the situations in the state during that time. But what I really saw that benefited my children was that we had a lot of flexibility and that I could see what their strengths were, what their weaknesses were. We could really address those. I had a child with learning disabilities. And so helping him navigate not just home and how to educate, you know, how to be educated, but also all my kids were in classes in the community, all went to either Wake Tech or Durham Tech. And so, you know, helping them navigate that situation, helping them develop their own passions, helping them figure out where to go next.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Kate. 877-962-9862 is the number to call. You know, Ethan, it seems to me that one of the commonalities that we're hearing here is this learner-driven kind of theory works very well. We've heard no objection about that, that following the child's interest seems to have really beneficial results. And then there are some of these other institutional concerns about integration and diversity. But I wonder if the education system can learn from that. Is there a way we can build a public school system that does some of these things? Apparently it's failing in some ways.
I mean, progressive pedagogy, the idea that we should follow the child has long been a pretty standard part of American educational thought. And, you know, we see it a lot in the younger grades where you see sort of more open play and sort of more child-directed stuff. I mean, there's no question that public schools are responsive to concerns from the public, that kids learn, that they learn at pace with students in other parts of the world. And so, you know, the public schools are constrained by, you know, sort of pervasive concern about the quality of public education. And so that tends toward a bit more structure. I mean, I think, you know, just going back to the previous conversation about the concerns around citizenship, I mean, one of the struggles that states have always had with trying to think about homeschooling is that public education has a bunch of different outcomes that we care about. So not just the academic, but also the socialization, the exposure. And historically, one of the reasons why homeschooling was seen as not in compliance with compulsory school laws was because of that socialization element. And that was for a long time seen as something that was really fundamental. And now with the focus on test scores, on achievement, we've pulled back from that, some of that, and focused a little bit more, even homeschooling, on showing that students are learning. But, you know, socialization was a really, really important part of the vision of public education for a long time.
Well, Thad, it seems to me also that the part of the problem here is how you measure that success. When you talk about a quality education, if that's the goal of a government, of a state, if what we want is quality, I mean, there's certainly a lot of controversy and a lot of doubt that the numeric testing number, the scores that we now apply to these children, is actually measuring quality. Do we need to come up with different standards and a better way of assessing what quality is before we say the state has imposed it beautifully?
We absolutely do. I think that the baseline measures of student achievement tell us something, and something that we care about. But it's a, you know, it's looking at a whole world through a peephole. We definitely need to be better at measuring and thinking about, or articulating, before we even worry about measuring, what we'd like to get from our school.
And knowing what the outcomes, what you want. Yeah. Valene?
Yeah, I guess I am a pessimist in that respect. The school system at large is such a grand thing, and I guess I just want to share that, again, that was one of my motivations for homeschooling and even starting in Part Minds Academy, and that was to protect the genius of my Black children. Yeah. So that's one thing I'm, like, really passionate and excited about daily. So we nurture Black learners at EMA, and that's another reason why a lot of families homeschool, especially African-American families, to really have agency and autonomy over what, you know, they're exposed to or what we're exposed to. And,
well, I would also say, forgive me for interrupting, and I, if you had more to say, I'll let you finish that thought, but it comes back to this question of citizenship and diversity. When we look at our schools now, the way they are resegregating, I don't know how much diversity you're getting in the average American public school. They have become resegregated to a point that you might think it was being done by law in this country. So I'm sure there's a certain amount of economic diversity, much more than you're going to find in a simple family. But that's not to say that we have tremendous or laudable diversity in our schools in America.
No, I mean, certainly not. And I mean, I think the concern is, you know, if for most of the history, people were committed to the public school system and to directing their energies toward developing better systems of education, or struggling with, you know, debates about outcomes in education. And those were directed to a communal sense, a broad communal sense of, you know, if the schools were imperfect, then we needed to work together to make them better. And I think some of the concern, at least, is that if people divest from the system and say, well, I'm going to do it my way, there's nothing wrong with that decision in terms of that may be what's best for an individual child or parent or family. But when you look back at the collective, you know, maybe there is something lost there where we're having fewer conversations as a group about what we want for all of our children.
What about that, Hope? If we go it alone, then we've really sort of we've given up on the public system entirely and said, you know, I got this.
I mean, I guess the larger scale issues are really beyond the scope of my project. And I would just say that I would look forward to an educational system that was flexible enough to contain some of these different models within the system. Having worked on the edges of the system, I've been teaching and facilitating homeschoolers for about 15 years, but also I've been in public schools as a guest teacher. And I just see the teachers shackled to these standards and curricula and unable to teach the way that they know children learn, or to let children have that freedom of spirit. And, you know, recess and the arts are always the first things to be cut. So to me, it's like I want people to chip in together and have that sense of community, that sense of commonality. But at the same time, I just see I want to create a better world than the one we're living in. And I want to inspire people by showing them what's possible in education.
Yeah, and I really like how one of our parents put it, sacred segregation. So yes, we are intentional about leading ourselves. You know, it's not about isolation or being sheltered. Our learners get lots of exposures. And we were able to practice liberation without the distraction of racism.
Thad, let me ask you this, whether or not, and I know Ethan put it beautifully, it's like, well, are we extracting ourselves? Are we withdrawing from a public conversation about how to make this thing better? If we've got a problem communally, let's all sit in the room until we figure this thing out. And it's not going to be easy and it's going to be messy, much of which would apply, I think, to your theories of education. Let's let them work it out. That is that happening in a sense? Is the public school system looking at the flight from the schools and saying, okay, the market has spoken, let's figure this out? They may not be at the table, but we're learning, we're hearing something from them. Are there lessons being drawn, and are we developing new theories in education that take into account these complaints?
I think schools are really working hard to become community centers in a lot of different ways, from finding ways to offer health care to students to finding ways to incorporate parents into school leadership. I think the public school system is also very diverse. So if you go around and visit a dozen elementary schools across the triangle, you're going to see very different models for community engagement. But you're going to see a lot of community engagement, and you're going to see a lot of work to get the community involved. So I think there's work to be done. I think it's something that schools traditional public school educators are really thoughtful about and that they worry about.
Yeah, I would like to agree with that point. After a talk that Hope and I both were involved in on Sunday, the earth is demanding all of our attention, and the use of technology is demanding all of our attention. So getting engaged together is very important for everyone.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Valene Ziegler is founder and head of Empowered Minds Academy. Hope Wilder is executive director of Pathfinder Community School. Ethan Hutt is assistant professor at UNC Chapel Hill School of Education, as is Thad Domina. And I want to thank you all for being on our program.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much, Frank.
And I want to thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Next, Movies on the Radio, we're going to talk about films about conspiracies and cover-ups. Send us your favorites, all kinds of movies about conspiracies and cover-ups, the parallax view, suddenly. Think broadly, think deeply. You can be on the show. Send us an email at sot@wnc.org. State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Grant Hall of Mormon. Robin Copley is our technical director. Josie Taras is our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.